It's the E-commerce Master Plan Podcast, here to help you grow your e-commerce business faster and more efficiently by cutting through the hype to bring you inspiration and guidance from the e-commerce sector and beyond. Here's your host, Chloe Thomas.
Hello, Master Plan World. Welcome to our latest podcast, our last podcast of 2016. And as always, it's a pleasure to have you all out there listening. I'm Chloe Thomas, creator of the E-commerce Master Plan, author, speaker and consultant, and I focus on e-commerce business strategy and marketing. Last time we visited the world of SaaS with Greg Smith of Thinkific, so if you haven't yet checked that one out, go and have a listen because there's some interesting tidbits in that one, as there always is in fact. Well, today I don't just have one interview for you, I have six. Yes, it's time to review 2016, and who better to do that with than our selection of experts from around the world of e-commerce. Today, the question they're answering is, what do you think was the most interesting thing in e-commerce in 2016? If you'd like to add your thoughts to the debate, then head over to our E-commerce Master Plan World Facebook group via ecommercemasterplan.com/Facebook. We're going to start off with a couple of points of view on Black Friday and how it's evolved this year. Starting off with Heather McIlvain, who's the editor of Australia's Internet Retailing Magazine. Now, don't be fooled by the accent. She might be an American, but Heather knows the Australian e-commerce world inside out.
I think 2016 will be remembered as the year the Global Online Shopping Festival really got big in Australia. So Australians are some of the biggest cross-border shoppers in the world. And of course, they've been shopping Black Friday and Cyber Monday deals for years overseas. But this year, they did that too this year. Australia was the third most popular shipping destination for Black Friday deliveries from the U.S. I think this year was a turning point. And we saw a much larger number of Australian retailers offering major discounts domestically as well. And I think one of the interesting things is, because there's not really, there's no allegiance to the tradition of Black Friday being traditionally a day about bricks and mortar deals and Cyber Monday being about online deals, we saw most retailers offering deep discounts across all their channels online and in store from Friday through to Monday, if not longer. The reason I chose the Global Online Shopping Festival was that in Australia, it wasn't just about Black Friday, although that was certainly the most covered in the news and I think the biggest in terms of what retailers are thinking about. But we also saw Australian retailers participating in China's Singles Day and our own homegrown Click Frenzy this year, even though the latter is continuously plagued by service failures. But even still, I think what's interesting about these things is that even though there's a larger number of retailers participating, even the retailers that don't participate and don't offer deals, they're still seeing a ripple effect and they're still seeing a sales uplift. And so I actually spoke with the CEO of Meijer, the department store chain, Richard Umbers, and he said that he saw an uptick in online sales at Meijer around Singles Day, even though the business wasn't offering any deals at the time. I mean, it doesn't even sell on Alibaba, and that's kind of a prerequisite for the Singles Day sale. So there's all of this hype about the event, and people aren't necessarily staying within the walls of that specific event when they go online. They're online, and they're looking at other things too. So I think what's happening is there's an incentive to do things that generate buzz. And I've heard from a number of retailers that their calendars are increasingly being driven by big online shopping events throughout the year. What's the impact of that going to be? And one example that I want to point to is kind of recently in the news down here, which is the online department store, Kogan.com, recently launched something called, they're calling hourly deals, where they're going to offer a really steep discount on one product every hour. And that's going to be happening, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And it seems kind of like a flash sale, but maybe because of the timing, because it's on the back of Black Friday, kind of rings that same tune. So it seems to be of a kind with those event-driven promotional discounts.
It's great to have the Australian perspective represented this year. I've been wanting someone from Australia on as in the expert seat since I started the podcast. It's great to finally achieve it. So thank you, Heather. And I'd love to know if that halo effect of Black Friday happened in the UK, and if anyone else out there is going all out on hourly deals. Do get in contact if you're up to that or know someone who is. Now for another perspective even on Black Friday from another expat American. This time it's an American based in the UK. I couldn't fit into the podcast, but he did publicly apologise for the whole concept on behalf of the country. So it's Skip Fedora of Dot Mailer.
We had this interesting conversation the other day about Black Friday and whether it was a thing or not a thing. And the person I was talking to said, well, it didn't seem to be a thing. There, you know, I could go to any website and I could do the, browse and shop. And, last year there were so many issues with so many different sites being down and not being able to handle the traffic. And this person was hypothesizing that, well, actually, it's not as big a thing for consumers. It's not, maybe they're not buying or whatever. And then we looked up the stats and the BBC was reporting that Black Friday was the biggest day ever. It was £1 billion worth of sales in one day and all that kind of stuff. And then we started looking at our own stats from here at Dot Mailer, and the number of emails we sent on Black Friday was up by 55% over last year. 10% of those were, roughly, went between 9 and 10 in the morning. So, I think Black Friday was a big thing. And I think for me, one of the maybe not the most interesting things in e-commerce in 2016, but definitely one of the success stories of e-commerce in 2016 is that we've figured out how to scale, and we've figured out how to deal with all the traffic.
So if we've learned how to scale, what's next?
Marketers' approach to this season is I described it as almost being wedding-like, in the sense that, when you get married, there's this big push in the lead-up to the big day, and you have the big day. And then the happy couple goes off on, a mini moon or a honeymoon or whatever it is. And then they come home and they're like, now what? and marketers seem to be doing the same thing. We've got this series of discrete events. It's Black Friday, then Cyber Monday, then Small Business Saturday, then Out of Stock Tuesday, and on and on and on and on and on. And then we get to the January sales. And then in February, everybody's sort of like, now what? I think one of the things that the better marketers are doing is thinking about how do I treat that whole period as a thing instead of a series of discrete events? How do I treat my existing customers, my loyal customers who have bought from me again this Christmas? How do I treat the existing customers who haven't bought yet? And I think most importantly, how do I treat the new customers? So 23% of your new customers will be won over the Christmas period, and 27% of those, or 6% of the total, will go on to buy again. And I think part of that is because marketers don't differentiate between people coming in new at Christmas and the rest of their customer base. And somebody comes in new, they buy something, they maybe go through a welcome journey, and then they get chucked into the normal marketing comms, which in the lead up to Christmas is all about sell, 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 sell. That's not the way to meet somebody new. That's not the way to build a relationship. The way to build a relationship is appreciate this time of year, they're going to be busy. They're going to be getting messages from lots of other people, and to back off. And, even the clever people might back off and say they're backing off. Too many marketers get that new customer at Christmas and they're shooting for that New Year's Eve date, when what they really want to be doing is thinking about how can I sell these people something not again before Christmas or not even in the January sales, how am I going to sell them something in March?
It does seem to me that in 2016, we finally started not just talking about segmentation and sequences, but actually started to do it. Maybe that's because we started to understand how to differentiate ourselves a bit more and the strengths we have as smaller rather than huge businesses. Well, here's Alex O'Byrne of the number one Shopify agency, We Make Websites, and he's going to talk us through how his most interesting thing of 2016 is realizing how the smaller retailer, whilst they can't compete with the bigger retailers with tech and new developments, we can beat them with personality in our brand stories by being unique, by being authentic, aka how to make the most of being small. Here's Alex.
The big retailers are getting better and better and better at doing what they do with more advanced technology and more advanced innovation. For example, Amazon Go offering their proof of concept frictionless store, or the way in which click and collect and true omnichannel is coming to many of the big brands. And a lot of the brands we work with are a bit smaller and can't do those sort of things. But it occurred to me this year that they are able to innovate on something that the big retailers can't, and that is the fact that people feel more of a connection to them, that they can often see the craft of a story behind the brand, and that the things they sell tend to be more special in some way. And for smaller brands, that's actually a great opportunity for them to be able to capitalize on that and do a good job of showing why they're different to an Amazon or an eBay or an Argos. I think the secret is to differentiate between whether you are a retailer that sells loads of stuff and is good at that, or is a retailer that is more focused on being a brand and having your customers get to know who you are and what you're about, because that's what people are looking for when they buy certain products. So if they're buying clothing or furniture or some other lifestyle product, very often they're willing to spend a bit more if they can feel like the brand is identifying them in some way. And I think doing a good job of being, it's an overused word, but being authentic and showing what you're about and why you're different is something that Amazon will never be able to do, because they'll always just be able to show, look, we sell all this stuff cheap, whereas you're able to say, look, this is our story, this is why we do what we do, and this is why you should buy from us. And I think a certain audience for each brand will recognize that, and that is how you build loyalty into your brand.
Well, let's dive into some of those big company ideas and how we smaller players can take advantage of it with Paul Skeldon, the editor of M Retailing. So guess what he's talking about? Yep, it's mobile.
For me, the most significant thing is that sort of routinely across most retailers, traffic and sales on mobile is now past 50%. And so you're finding kind of a lot of retailers seeing a huge amount of business now coming through the mobile channel. M&S seeing their mobile phone sales, individual sales from people have gone from 7 million in 2012 to 80 million in 2015. It's massive growth. John Lewis has seen sort of its mobile sort of sales drive e-commerce up from 34% to 86%. Ocado is seeing 50% of its traffic recently coming from mobile. Mobile's just sort of taking over. And I think sort of the idea that mobile now is something somehow separate from e-commerce is almost bunk. It's just sort of different ways of doing the same thing. People just reach for whatever they have to hand to buy things, and increasingly don't sort of think too much about whether it's a mobile device, a website, or whatever. And most of the big retailers have got all that in line. The experience you get online is very similar to the experience you get on your mobile or your tablet. And I think we're going to see that filter down into sort of smaller and smaller retailers until it's just the accepted norm. Because these days, anyone looking to buy something is going to open someone's website. If it doesn't work on a mobile, they're probably just going to go straight away somewhere else. So, you know, it's an imperative. I think related to that, it's also quite interesting. In recent months, we've seen quite a lot of growing interest amongst retailers in mobile payments. Now, consumers have been quite keen on using mobile as a payment tool, or a small sort of, you know, a hardy bunch of them have for some time. It's starting to spread, I think, as Apple Pay gets more sort of entrenched in more Apple users' hands. But you're starting to see retailers now get research from Visa shows that like 54 to sort of 60% of consumers are wanting to do it regularly. And the 18% who haven't yet used it were very keen to find out how to do this.
A great example of mobile payments is from one of our past podcast guests, Deborah Lipman, who sell nail varnish, and they added Apple Pay options to their emails and saw huge conversion rates, including lots from customers who'd never bought from them before, and all without the customer even having to visit the website. So I asked him what the approach on mobile should be. Should it be web? Should it be app? Should it be just selling from the emails, or what?
I think ideally you need to have a mobile-first design that works on web and works on pretty much any device that you can think of, including, let's not forget, TVs, because I think we're going to start to see a lot more apps on TVs and things where people can buy things. I think you also need to have apps, and you need to have a website, as I say, that works on mobile. Now, increasingly, are on your mobile phone, and you try to buy something from, or you Google something, you'll get a website. Say you want to buy a pair of shoes from ASOS or whatever. Google will take you to ASOS's website. You click on it. If you've already got the ASOS app, it will just fire up the app on your phone, and then you're taken into the app experience. Not just with ASOS, this happens with any retail app that you've got on your smartphone. So in many ways, you have to have both. But what's great about it for retailers is because of the way Google now works, directs the sort of traffic, or rather fires it up as a web link, but your phone recognises that you have the app, is that you do then get funneling more people from sort of natural search into using a native app, which is where you can have a lot more fun with them and learn a lot more about them, and give them a much richer experience. So you need to have both. And it's expensive and difficult.
We need both a mobile-friendly site and an app, and it's going to be both expensive and difficult. Thanks, Paul. So I asked Paul what the smaller retailer should do.
For the smaller players, this is you know, the sort of nirvana that they eventually will have to reach. I think, sort of as with all these things, the cost of doing it will slowly come down. I think you have to learn from what the sort of big retailers who can afford to do this are doing. But I think what you need to do in lieu of not being able to necessarily afford an app, and I personally wouldn't sort of say go buy an app straight away. That's the wrong way around to do it. You need to have a mobile-first designed website. And you need to make sure that the design and functionality of that gives the best app-like experience that you can. Because it's all coming down to sort of how people experience you, and they want a slick and nice experience. Now, back to the sort of earlier point about sort of just embedding the payment into your marketing emails. I mean, that sort of bypasses having to have all this sort of stuff. However, I don't think you should, you know, do that. You still have to have a really good sort of adaptable, responsive website that will work on mobile and deliver a great experience. And that can be done.
Phew. Well, you can still do it with just a good website. But please don't try to rely on Apple Pay only if your website works appallingly on mobile. It might be a stopgap, but you're clearly going to need to get that mobile optimized site working by the time we get to 2018. So put it on your to-do list. Of course, all this cross-device consumer behaviour does make tracking rather difficult. Or does it? Here's Anne-Sophie Forget, an e-commerce professional working for a big agency, with her most important learning from 2016.
If I have one thing to choose, it would be cross-device tracking and measuring. And the reason is we all know that mobile is growing. I think now the searching on mobile overtaking the searches on desktop, especially in the e-commerce vertical. And everyone has known that for quite some time. But this year it was really about really take this idea of mobile and how we can justify the investment mobile and really show the value. So one of the idea to show the value is look at how much we invest in mobile and look at after that what's the consumer doing and really reach this customer throughout the journey and deliver some specific messages. So a lot of our clients put cross-device tracking to justify the investment of mobile as being really part of the purchase journey.
So you're talking about creating ad campaigns and activity that follow the user as they move from device to platform to search engine, I suppose, and then making sure the right message is in the right place?
That's correct. And what we saw on AdWords specifically, on for example, is we are able now to put some cross-tracking device to really show the value of the mobile investment, because on last click. Usually it doesn't contribute that much, and show that it really brings value and you need to reach those customers, especially when you're on your mobile, you're in your train, for example, you actually have time to read and get this, the brand can get this awareness from this phase, so we shouldn't just leave it on the side. We should completely embrace this medium as well.
Well, cool. So it's both about the tracking and the results, so seeing the full picture, but also about the right message in the right place.
Absolutely.
It's not exactly what you wanted, is it? Google Ads to get any more complex? Okay, our final expert is Chris Dawson of Tame Bay. Ever ready with an alternative take on things, what's his most interesting thing in e-commerce in 2016?
The rise of the new devices. And by that, I mean, we started off with computers and laptops, and then we went mobile with mobile phone tablets. But we've seen a new generation of devices come along, which are screenless devices. Things like Amazon Alexa was the first. And then we've got Google Home come along. And Amazon Alexa, you can actually do shopping on it. Although, my God, it is so limited. It is unbelievable. Google Home, you can't even do shopping on. But this is just the very first incantation of kind of artificial intelligence and voice-only devices. And that, I believe, is how the future of the internet is going to be and how we're going to communicate with the net in the future. There'll be devices listening, maybe around the home, maybe wearable devices. I don't know, but there'll be devices listening all of the time. We'll only have to speak to the internet to get things done. And that's going to include e-commerce.
So do you think that in a few years' time, we'll be looking back and going, oh my God, you used a keyboard?
Absolutely. And nowadays, I've got a mobile phone. I hardly ever use the keyboard. Even if I'm in the car, I want to send a text message. I just say, OK, Google, send a text message to Chloe, and it'll find your telephone number in my phone book. It'll bring it out, and I can say, tell Chloe I'm going to be late. So send Chloe a text message saying I'm running 10 minutes late, and it'll send you a text message saying, oh, Chris is running 10 minutes late. I don't need to use a keyboard even today.
Wow, crazy times. So I had to ask, Chris, what the impact will be on e-commerce. And this is where it gets proper interesting.
Well, the big thing with this is how does that artificial intelligence inside whatever robot machine we're talking to find out what we want to buy? So I'm going to take something really, really simple, which is let's say you're in the market for a new iPhone. And you want an iPhone 7, you want the big one, and you want the pink one. So you say to the device, whether it be Alexa or Google Home or an eBay device or whatever device it happens to be, I want to buy a new iPhone, I want the big one, and I want it in pink. Mm-hmm. That device has now got to translate, I want an iPhone, the new one is the latest one, that's got to be the iPhone 7. That is a product attribute. And then you said you want the big one, and this artificial intelligence has got to realize that the big one actually means the iPhone 7 Plus, not the basic iPhone. And then that's another product attribute. And then color is an attribute. You said you want the pink one. And this artificial intelligence has got to realize that there are no pink iPhones. Apple called that color rose gold. So it's got to equate pink to rose gold. Now, first of all, this device has got to be able to do that translation, which any shop assistant selling iPhones, when you say I want a pink one, they'll get you a rose gold one.
Yeah.
They know those two things equate to each other. But the other thing is, this product attributes have to be contained in some sort of database, in some sort of structured data, so that those connections can actually be made. So retailers have got to get those product attributes built into their data sets, whether it be on marketplaces like eBay and Amazon, whether it be on their website. And in actual fact, it all comes back down to what we call a GTIN, or the product barcode, which all those attributes can be related to a barcode. That product data is going to be so essential, because now we can't even see a picture of the device. We're not typing anything. We're just talking to not a person, but a thing that has got to translate what we tell it we want to what it actually knows that means we actually want in reality.
So I asked Chris, is this all on the retailer to get it done?
Well, I don't think we necessarily have to list, as a retailer, we have to list the colour as pink and as rose gold. What we have to do is make use of the attributes that the marketplace or site that we're listing on uses. So for instance, on Amazon, when you're listing a product, they have what they call maps, so that you can map different colors against a single color. So you might list the attribute as rose gold, and then you might map that color to, if someone types in gold or pink or rose gold, they all equate to the rose gold color. Mm-hmm. So we can actually help on sites like Amazon by mapping alternatives to the actual attribute. Again, it might be a manufacturer specifies a brown jumper as a burnt umber jumper. It's very unlikely that a consumer is going to search for a burnt umber jumper. So we want to map that, that if they search for burnt umber, it actually equates to, if they search for brown, that's what we want it to be looking for. So we can help as retailers, but it's really down to the people that are constructing these structured data sets to help us, to help them, and to give us the facility to actually map different attributes and colours. But then ultimately, when I say I want the big iPhone or the large iPhone, somehow that artificial intelligence has got a map that the big iPhone is relating to. There's an iPhone and there's an iPhone Plus, and the iPhone Plus is a bigger screen.
And actually, the iPhone is actually quite a simple product to try and buy vocally.
Yeah, there's only a couple of options. It's like, how much memory do you want and what screen size do you want? But it also gets a lot more complicated if you think of something as simple as a printed T-shirt. Let's say that there's 10 different designs in 6 different colours in 8 different sizes. I want a black T-shirt with AC/DC printed on it in size large. That's quite a simple thing for me to tell you, but this artificial intelligence has now got 3 different attributes in structured data, and it's got to get all 3 right. I think the most important points are that retailers need to ensure that they've got their structured data as correct and comprehensive as possible, preferably working with someone like GS1, who will tie that structured data to a GTIN, that's to an EAN, a European article number for us, or an EAN for the US, or different numbers for around the world, but we'll call it a GTIN. And that structured data can be tied to that GTIN, either by the manufacturer, by a different retailer, by ourselves. Everyone can help build that structured data, and then wherever that GTIN appears, GS1 in the background will have the structured data linked to irrevocably to that GTIN, so that then any artificial intelligence device can actually interrogate that data. Similarly with Amazon, you don't actually own the listing on Amazon. There's a single product detail page which Amazon and multiple sellers can all contribute to build up that data set. Retailers and things like Amazon Alexa can interrogate that data set and find out which product we're actually looking for. In truth, it will assist you even on laptops, computers, or mobile devices like tablets and iPads today. But in the future, when we go to screenless devices where I can't see a picture to confirm that what you're offering me is what I actually want to buy, it will become even more essential that we get these details correct.
So I see all of your future, and it involves a lot of product attributes. But don't assume that's all the future holds. Our experts will be back in early January to answer, what's your number one marketing recommendation for e-commerce in 2017? Well, Masterplan World, you can find out more about our experts and what they've been telling us about at ecommercemasterplan.com/82. As well as the next expert show, we have a lot coming up for you in January as we've put together a whole series, the 2017 e-commerce growth series sponsored by Vico, the number one inventory software. Coming up over the next 10 episodes, we have interviews with a fascinating set of e-commerce businesses, even if I do say so myself, each of which is going to help you to work out how to deal with one of the key challenges you will tell me about. Plus, we have some expert viewpoints on buying a business, selling a business, and starting a business. Wow. As well as tips on marketing for 2017 from our experts. So Make sure you come back next time, because we're going to have the first in that growth series, which is the Shopify Builder Business Winners Best Self Co. Have a great week, have a good new year, and don't forget to keep optimizing.
Thank you for listening to the E-Commerce Master Plan podcast. Find out more at ecommercemasterplan.com.